Chapter 47. Afraid it was not lawful for him to marry the queen. Not one of those priests had the courage to hint that it was rather curious he had never thought of that before, and that his mind seemed to have been in a tolerably jolly condition during a great many years, in which he certainly had not fretted himself thin. But, they all said, ah, that was very true, and it was a serious business. And perhaps the best way to make it right would be for His Majesty to be divorced. The king replied, yes, he thought that would be the best way, certainly. So they all went to work. If I were to relate to you the intrigues and plots that took place in the endeavor to get this divorce, you would think the history of England the most tiresome book in the world. So I shall say no more than that after a vast deal of negotiation and evasion, the Pope issued a commission to Cardinal Wolsey and Cardinal Campeggio, whom he sent over from Italy for the purpose, to try the whole case in England. It is supposed, and I think with reason, that Wolsey was the Queen's enemy, because she had reproved him for his proud and gorgeous manner of life. But, he did not at first know that the king wanted to marry Anne Boleyn, and when he did know it, he even went down on his knees in the endeavor to dissuade him. The cardinals opened their court in the convent of the Black Friars, near to where the bridge of that name in London now stands, and the king and queen, that they might be near it, took up their lodgings at the adjoining palace of Bridewell, of which nothing now remains but a bad prison. On the opening of the court, when the king and queen were called on to appear, that poor ill-used lady, with a dignity and firmness, and yet with a womanly affection worthy to be always admired, went and kneeled at the king's feet, and said that she had come, a stranger, to his dominions, that she had been a good and true wife to him for 20 years, and that she could acknowledge no power in those cardinals to try whether she should be considered his wife after all that time, or should be put away. With that, she got up and left the court, and would never afterwards come back to it. The king pretended to be very much overcome, and said, oh, my lords and gentlemen, what a good woman she was to be sure, and how delighted he would be to live with her unto death, but for that terrible uneasiness in his mind which was quite wearing him away. So, the case went on, and there was nothing but talk for 2 months. Then Cardinal Campeggio, who, on behalf of the Pope, wanted nothing so much as delay, adjourned it for 2 more months. And before that time was elapsed, the Pope himself adjourned it indefinitely, by requiring the king and queen to come to Rome, and have it tried there. But by good luck for the king, word was brought to him by some of his people, that they had happened to meet at supper Thomas Cranmer, a learned doctor of Cambridge, who had proposed to urge the Pope on, by referring the case to all the learned doctors and bishops, here and there and everywhere, and getting their opinions, that the king's marriage was unlawful. The king, who was now in a hurry to marry Anne Boleyn, thought this such a good idea, that he sent for Cranmer, post haste, and said to Lord Rochfort, Anne Boleyn's father, take this learned doctor down to your country house, and there let him have a good room for a study, and no end of books out of which to prove that I may marry your daughter. Apostrophe Lord Rochfort, not at all reluctant, made the learned doctor as comfortable as he could, and the learned doctor went to work to prove his case. All this time, the king and Anne Boleyn were writing letters to one another almost daily, full of impatience to have the case settled, and Anne Boleyn was showing herself, as I think, very worthy of the fate which afterwards befell her. It was bad for Cardinal Wolsey that he had left Cranmer to render this help. It was worse for him that he had tried to dissuade the king from marrying Anne Boleyn. Such a servant as he, to such a master as Henry, would probably have fallen in any case. But, between the hatred of the party of the queen that was, and the hatred of the party of the queen that was to be, he fell suddenly and heavily. Going down one day to the court of Chancery, where he now presided, He was waited upon by the Dukes of Norfolk and Suffolk, who told him that they brought an order to him to resign that office, and to withdraw quietly to a house he had at Esher, in Surrey. The cardinal refusing, they rode off to the king, and next day came back with a letter from him, on reading which, the cardinal submitted. An inventory was made out of all the riches in his palace at York Place, now Whitehall, and he went sorrowfully up the river, in his barge, to Putney. An abject man he was, in spite of his pride, for being overtaken, riding out of that place towards Esher, by one of the king's chamberlains who brought him a kind message and a ring, he alighted from his mule, took off his cap, and kneeled down in the dirt. His poor fool, whom in his prosperous days he had always kept in his palace to entertain him, cut a far better figure than he. For, when the cardinal said to the chamberlain, that he had nothing to send to his lord the king as a present, but that jester who was a most excellent one, it took six strong yeomen, to remove the faithful fool from his master. The once proud cardinal was soon further disgraced, and wrote the most abject letters to his vile sovereign, who humbled him one day, and encouraged him the next, according to his humor, until he was at last ordered to go, and reside in his diocese of York. He said he was too poor, but I don't know how he made that out, for he took 160 servants with him, and 72 cartloads of furniture, food, and wine. He remained in that part of the country for the best part of a year, and showed himself so improved by his misfortunes, and was so mild and so conciliating, that he won all hearts. And indeed, even in his proud days, he had done some magnificent things for learning and education. At last, he was arrested for high treason, and, coming slowly on his journey towards London, got as far as Leicester. Arriving at Leicester Abbey after dark, and very ill, he said when the monks came out at the gate with lighted torches to receive him, that he had come to lay his bones among them. He had indeed, for he was taken to a bed, from which he never rose again. His last words were, "Had I but served God as diligently as I have served the king, he would not have given me over, in my gray hairs. Howbeit, this is my just reward for my pains and diligence, not regarding my service to God, but only my duty to my prince." The news of his death was quickly carried to the king, who was amusing himself with archery in the garden of the magnificent palace at Hampton Court, which that very Wolsey had presented to him. The greatest emotion his royal mind displayed at the loss of a servant, so faithful and so ruined, was a particular desire to lay hold of £1,500 which the cardinal was reported to have hidden somewhere. The opinions concerning the divorce, of the learned doctors and bishops and others, being at last collected, and being generally in the king's favor, were forwarded to the Pope, with an entreaty that he would now grant it. The unfortunate Pope, who was a timid man, was half distracted between his fear of his authority being set aside in England, if he did not do as he was asked, and his dread of offending the Emperor of Germany, who was Queen Catherine's nephew. In this state of mind he still evaded and did nothing. Then, Thomas Cromwell, who had been one of Wolsey's faithful attendants, and had remained so even in his decline, advised the king to take the matter into his own hands, and make himself the head of the whole church. This, the king by various artful means, began to do, but he recompensed the clergy, by allowing them to burn as many people as they pleased, for holding Luther's opinions. You must understand that Sir Thomas More, the wise man who had helped the king with his book, had been made chancellor in Wolsey's place. But, as he was truly attached to the church as it was even in its abuses, he, in this state of things, resigned. Being now quite resolved to get rid of Queen Catherine, and to marry Anne Boleyn without more ado, the king made Cranmer Archbishop of Canterbury, and directed Queen Catherine to leave the court. She obeyed, but replied that wherever she went, she was Queen of England still, and would remain so, to the last. The king then married Anne Boleyn privately, and the new Archbishop of Canterbury, within half a year, declared his marriage with Queen Catherine void, and crowned Anne Boleyn queen. She might have known that no good could ever come from such wrong, and that the corpulent brute who had been so faithless, and so cruel to his first wife, could be more faithless, and more cruel to his second. She might have known that, even when he was in love with her, he had been a mean and selfish coward, running away, like a frightened cur, from her society and her house, when a dangerous sickness broke out in it, and when she might easily have taken it and died, as several of the household did. But, Anne Boleyn arrived at all this knowledge too late, and bought it at a dear price. Her bad marriage with a worse man, came to its natural end. Its natural end was not, as we shall too soon see, a natural death for her. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.